Hello, listeners. It is Thursday, June 15th. I'm Scott Bland, your host, and you are listening to Politico's Nerdcast. Well, last week we talked about Virginia's primaries for governor, but while the Democratic side was the hot ticket going in, it was actually the GOP primary that ended up being much, much closer. Corey Stewart, an underfunded Trump-supporting county supervisor who made his big splash in the campaign defending Confederate monuments, came very close to beating Ed Gillespie, a former Republican National Committee chairman. We'll talk about what that means for the governor's race and whether it has any broader implications for the Republican primary heading into primaries next year for the 2018 elections, among other things. We'll also talk about the White House trying to rally big GOP donors to give a jumpstart to its policy agenda. But we're going to start off today's episode by talking about the shooting that happened at a practice for the Republican congressional baseball team on Wednesday. House Majority Whip Steve Scalise and others were shot by a gunman who was ultimately shot and killed by Capitol Police officers who were there and prevented things from getting worse than they were. So we're going to talk a little bit about that, some of the reaction to that, and whether it's going to herald a little bit of a change in our politics or not. A few quick items before we jump into all that. Remember, if you have questions for the Nerdcast crew, you can email us at nerdcast@politico.com. And as always, please remember to subscribe, rate us, and write written reviews of the Nerdcast on iTunes or your preferred podcast platform. We're always looking to grow the show, find more listeners, and also make it better for you, our listeners. So the more feedback we get, the better. All right, and with that, let's welcome our guests on the Nerdcast today. We have national political reporter Eliana Johnson.
Hola.
Chief investigative reporter Ken Vogel.
That's me. Hi.
And senior reporter Nancy Cook.
Hi, guys.
Get your fill of Ken in while you can today, everybody.
That's right. This is my last Nerdcast. I'm leaving Politico after 10 and a half amazing years going over to the New York Times. I'm going to miss you guys.
We'll miss you, Ken.
Unfortunately, we could not get the rights to play Green Day's Time of Our Lives over top of this, but you will be missed, Ken, for sure.
Yeah. It's playing in my head right now.
All right.
Another
so,
turning point.
Get it.
So, first segment up today. No data point for this one. It kind of speaks for itself. It's the shooting that happened on Wednesday in Virginia that wounded House Majority Whip Steve Scalise and others at a practice for the Republican congressional baseball team. Scalise is still in the hospital. He's in critical condition, multiple surgeries. This has sparked a lot of conversation in the past 24 hours about divisive political rhetoric and you know, violent rhetoric and whether or not that played a role in sparking this event, and you know, whether the divisiveness of this era is different or worse than it's been in the past. And obviously, this is not the first time in recent years we've seen a member of Congress get shot. Go back to 2011, Gabby Giffords in Tucson.
Yeah, you know, as to the question as to whether this is different or worse than in the past, I mean, clearly it's hugely significant. We should not take lightly that a member of Congress, a member of congressional leadership who is in line to the presidency, was attacked and critically wounded. Obviously, we're hoping for the best for Steve Scalise. You know, that's a violation in some ways of it's not just a crime, it's a violation of like this, you know, trust that we have in our elected leadership and the sort of way that we, you know, we expect a lot of our political leadership, but we should, treat them in a certain way in return. But you know, I do think there's a little bit of sort of short-sightedness around the reaction, this thinking that this is somehow like a pivotal moment or that it's going to change. It's going to, in some ways, you know, tone down the political rhetoric of divisiveness. You know, we haven't seen that in the past. You mentioned Gabby Giffords. There was a brief moment of unity after that and you know, even a little bit of debate over gun control, but very short-lived. Additionally, I think, like, it highlights a little bit of, like, self-absorption in Washington, D.C. Like, there's political violence. Unfortunately, there was political violence as recently as last year at Donald Trump rallies, and there are lawsuits working their way through state and federal courts over that. And, you know, there wasn't the same kind of reaction to it as we're seeing now. There's also, you know, there's gun crime all over the country every day. Crimes involving firearms, people dying, and we don't see this level of reaction. So the fact that here in Washington, D.C., there's this concentration of media and politics and this sort of political media industrial complex, we tend to take these things much more seriously and sort of spotlight them in maybe a somewhat disproportionate way when they hit close to home. I think that's what's happening now. Obviously, in no way am I intending to diminish the significance or, you know, really horrific nature of this.
I thought one of the really dispiriting things that was coming out yesterday in a stream of dispiriting news was that amidst all the reaction to this, that a number of other members of Congress, Republican and Democrat, described getting death threats emailed to them or to their offices as this news was coming out. People saying, "You're next," or like horrific things like that. And it seems at least like it's certainly easier now for people to make those kind of threats over the internet. And it seems like it just seems like there's more of it going on. Whether that means, you know, more people are acting on it, I think is actually a very different and separate thing. But it was pretty stunning to watch.
And it's more on both sides. It's more that it like allows, you know, it sort of creates the divisiveness in some ways, people attacking each other on social media behind the sort of anonymity of their egg avatar and their fake name. And it also allows people to disseminate these threats. And like we see that in the media, too. I mean, I remember... Yes. Like I actually felt like some of the most sort of aggressive targeting of me was back in 2008 covering the Clinton campaign. Interestingly, I got like people emailing me death threats through like the Politico web interface with these like made up email addresses that I couldn't trace. But I think it's just so much more common now that we get these things through social media and through, you know, direct messages and the like that, you know, we tend to like not take them seriously. And this shows ways in which they can be taken seriously. It also shows how the sort of dilemma for law enforcement, how do they know what's serious when there's just this deluge of really aggressive, threatening language? And this guy, the alleged shooter, had a history of such rhetoric on social media that obviously did not tip the alarm. And, you know, I guess probably should have in retrospect. But with so many people out there saying similar things, how do you know what's serious?
Well, I think one of the things that's too bad, too, is that so many lawmakers were quite shaken yesterday about what had happened and the shooting. You know, Congress is, you know, pretty small place and everyone knows each other. And, you know, one of the concerns that I have moving forward is just, you know, one of the great things about Congress is you can walk up to lawmakers and, you know, lawmakers have town halls in their home districts. And if there's all these security threats and people are getting death threats, like, will some of that transparency and just voters' access to their lawmakers go away? Like, will lawmakers want to do town halls this summer if they're worried about getting shot? You know, will they want to do appearances in public as much? You know, the
way they want to run for reelection.
Right. I mean, well, that's a whole different story. But just, you know, will they want to be out there as much public facing? And I think that that's a really key part of being a member of Congress and a key thing to have voters be able to interact with them and also just hold them accountable and talk to them.
I'm just going to go out on a limb and say I don't think this is going to change much of anything. I think members of Congress are going to continue to be publicly accessible. I don't think the shooting will change many of their personal plans to run for reelection. I think it's, you know, I don't think that political rhetoric was really to blame for this. You can't blame Bernie Sanders for one of his supporters going out and doing something crazy, and you can't blame Sarah Palin for, you know, one of her, you know, arguably one of her supporters going out and doing something crazy. I think they're crazy people in a big country who are going to unfortunately go out and do crazy things. And the fact is, I think now the connection to politics is that polls show increasingly people increasingly define themselves by their political party. They're more and more bothered by their children marrying members of a different political party, and perhaps that's why there is more political violence. But I think if it wasn't political violence, it would be something else. There's just changing affiliations over time.
I think that's a really good point, is that this is what people latch on to right now as opposed to something else. And with respect to the Giffords shooting in 2011, it's not even clear. I think there's actually a big controversy about this right now.
The guy was full-fledged, diagnosed, mentally ill.
Right.
Unlike the shooting yesterday, where it doesn't appear to have been.
He may have latched on to political rhetoric, but he wasn't necessarily kind of primarily motivated by politics, right? Like Eliana said, it's taking on this kind of like blood sport place in people's psyches.
I think people define themselves more and more by political ideology as opposed to their religion or their families. And the internet has helped by, I think, increasing isolation and perhaps depression, unhappiness, and those sorts of things. But my general view is that it's difficult. And I heard an FBI profiler interviewed this morning saying, how do you pinpoint what made somebody snap at this point rather than 6 weeks from now or 2 weeks prior? It's very difficult to define, you know, what makes somebody snap in a given moment and whether it really is politics or if it might not have been something else at a different time.
Well, and just for context, the Washington Post had this great graphic yesterday. This is actually the 154th mass shooting this year. I feel like that's become such a common occurrence that we don't – I mean, obviously this happened in Washington. It targeted members of Congress, so it was quite high profile. But these have been happening, you know, with great regularity all the time.
Like we mentioned at the top of the segment, this is still a developing story. Congressman Scalise still in the hospital. Hopefully his treatment goes well and he and the other victims of the shooting enjoy speedy recoveries. And we'll be checking back in on this story as it continues to unravel over the course of the next few weeks. All right. Well, let's shift from there into a little bit more of the news that we were expecting to be following this week before the shooting kind of intervened and really took over what everyone was thinking about and talking about earlier this week. Our data point for our second segment is the number 12, and that's from about a dozen Republican megadonors collectively representing hundreds of millions of dollars in political giving, gathered with President Donald Trump's legislative director in the White House last week to try and rally support for the Trump agenda. And this meeting, which was reported by Politico's Tara Palmieri and Ken Vogel, came days after White House Legislative Director Mark Short acknowledged that the Russia investigation has hampered that Trump agenda. And on the same day that James Comey testified before Congress in yet another example of the way that investigation continues to hamper and distract attention from this. So Ken, you wrote the story. It seems like an effort to kind of reset, restart, refocus on some legislation. Which we've talked about hitting trouble for a few weeks now because it's just very hard for people to focus on, for Congress to focus, for the White House to focus on agenda items.
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, there's a little more here, and that's that some in the White House privately blame the lack of support from some of these big money outside groups that are funded by these very donors who were brought in for this briefing, for the inability to get the legislative agenda on track, and particularly the initial failure to pass the AHCA, the Obamacare repeal and replace bill through the House. Of course, it subsequently was passed. A different version of it was passed. But if you remember, that was like just a huge embarrassment for the White House and for House Speaker Paul Ryan that this bill didn't pass the first time. And some of the folks in the White House point the fingers at these constellation of outside groups that are typically supportive of Republicans and Republican legislative priorities that were largely silent. And some of that is that Trump just never had a whole lot of support from the big money class, as well as, nor rather did he have support from, you know, some of these traditional outside groups. He did have support from some, like the Heritage Foundation, which Nancy and others at Politico, Eliana as well, have written extensively about. But
don't forget me, Ken.
Right. No, those are many,
credit,
many
co-bylines.
In fact, I think I squeezed in as a third byline on some of your stories. freeloading off you guys and your great sources and insight into the conservative movement. But nonetheless, this is a group that is seen as pivotal for if there are going to be legislative victories and a legislative agenda, whatever that might look like, that this group is seen as pivotal. And I think that was highlighted by the fact you mentioned that Mark Short gave the briefing. That's right, he did. And it's also important to note that Mark Short has deep connections to the party's money class, having worked a stint as sort of the head of the Koch brothers outside advocacy network. But nonetheless, President Trump himself stopped by this briefing to say hi, as did Vice President Mike Pence, who actually spent some time at the briefing. Reince Priebus, the White House Chief of Staff, Senior Counselor Kellyanne Conway, all stopped by this briefing just for 12 people. So that shows you how important this is. It also answers the question, what was Trump doing on the day of the Comey testimony? Well, this is part of it.
And Nancy, I mean, you've talked about it. It seems like this effort is obviously trying to gin up support for the big ticket items. Ken mentioned healthcare. There's a few other things, and we'll get to healthcare again in a minute. But Nancy, you've seen a little bit more of a focus on kind of small ball items recently, just to try and start to, not to return to the ball metaphor, but to try and get the ball rolling a little bit on some accomplishments.
Yeah, I mean, healthcare and tax reform are sort of the big goals of this administration and the big goals, I would say, of what Republicans really want to be able to deliver to voters in time for the 2018 midterms. But I also feel like there's been a realization at the White House that it's kind of important to highlight these smaller ball things that they're doing. They've been, you know, on the 100-day mark, they tried to highlight, for instance, all of their work that they've done to roll back Obama regulations. And they have done quite a lot of work to roll back the Obama's legacy. But more recently, we've seen them emphasizing things like, you know, Infrastructure Week and workforce development.
Although Infrastructure Week also happened to coincide with Comey Testimony Week. And there were a lot of snide comments about that, you know, because there was not a whole lot of discussion of infrastructure about, like, how's Infrastructure Week going for you?
Well, and that's part of it, right? They're trying to unveil not even like these fully fleshed out proposals, but just some other ideas that they have that they can do through executive orders to try to sort of say, hey, we're still trying to do things legislatively or at least through executive action on policy. And we're not totally swamped by the Comey stuff and the Russia investigations. I feel like there's a real sensitivity internally to that.
And this is also, I think, feeds into the desire to sign a bunch of executive orders just to show progress on something. You know, it's interesting. I think all presidents come into office and they have like big plans, and they kind of like look down on some of the small ball stuff. In fact, Obama himself famously swept into office, you know, saying that they weren't going to do small ball. He said, quote, not going to do school uniforms. And that was a, you know, a slight at the Clinton administration, the last Democratic administration before him, focusing on some of these small ball things, including school uniform proposals. But nonetheless, Obama himself, despite obviously having Obamacare and some other, you know, big ticket accomplishments, ended up pushing some modest proposals as well, like, you know, jobs proposals, a new a fatherhood pledge, graphic tobacco warnings, updated sunscreen requirements, an anti-bullying summit. So this is sort of in that small ball territory, the money ball, if you will, which might please the big money donors. I don't know. Actually, I think they probably want tax reform. But nonetheless, it's sort of similar to what Obama was doing, you know, late in his first term after Obamacare, and what Bill Clinton famously did when he was under siege.
Yeah, but I think the difference is that Obama did do small ball stuff after, you know, his 2 years.
Big ball. After big ball stuff.
After, but yeah, he did big ball stuff, though. I'm going to stop this ball metaphor, honestly. It's becoming ridiculous. But,
you know actually, for our listeners, I should just point out, since they can't see, that at the political offices for 10-plus years, I've been sitting on a giant blue inflatable exercise ball. So anytime they're ball analogies or metaphors, it often comes back to me. I thank you guys for not doing it, but I'm just preemptively putting it out there on my last Nerdcast so everyone knows, yes, I sit on a big blue ball. What?
Ken has killer abs.
It's my core more. But thanks for noticing.
The abs hold the core together.
The abs are the back of the core?
Yeah.
Cool. I feel like this segment is starting to
okay,
not be
I'm
held
gonna
together.
I'm going to drag it out of the gutter and bring it back to the wonkiness. Basically, the point is that Obama, in his first 2 years, you know, they did the health care law. They did Dodd-Frank. They passed the stimulus bill. You know, they ended up definitely paying for it politically by losing the House. And they did a lot of that just through Democrats. They didn't have really Republican support. However, they did do a lot of things. And I feel like Republicans had this hope, since they controlled Congress and the White House, that Trump would also be able to do those things. And there's some disappointment that they have been so slow to do it, and also some growing anxiety, I would say, about what that means for 2018.
You know, if the White House is blaming some of these top dollar donors for their inability to push things through Congress, I think that shows you that the White House is grasping at straws, looking for explanations about why they haven't been able to push their legislative agenda. They've also been saying that the Russia investigation and the ballooning scandals are preventing them from pushing things through Congress. You know, I would ask, what exactly have those investigations prevented them from pushing through Congress? I really don't think they prevented anything from getting through Congress. And it's unclear exactly what the White House's legislative agenda is at this point. I think there would be strong support for a tax reform bill. The White House has yet to produce that bill. What we have so far is one page of bullet points. And when the president has gone to the Hill to push his health reform package, he's only undermined the work that was done in the House. So I think the White House has its own problems. And I would add to the fact, in courting these top dollar donors and supporters, the president ran on a platform of not needing their help and so on. So the White House is in a difficult situation, but I think it's difficult for them to lay the blame at the feet of top dollar donors. I think they have to look to, you know, their inability to push substance to the Hill and then let Republican leadership on the Hill carry the ball forward.
That's a really good point. I mean, if you look at one of the most active Republican outside groups this year has been American Action Network, which has been really pushing health care reform. They've done some tax stuff, too. But if you look at the content of the ads that they've actually been putting out, it's very vague because, again, this is all happening like very quietly behind closed doors. The public principles sometimes don't all add up. But also, their effort to build this case in public, I think, and to build backing for it in public, I think, is what has gotten distracted by the Russia investigation. And Ken, I mean, we saw this again yesterday, right? Your story about these donors trying to kind of wrangle these donors to give some air cover happened at the same time as some big developments in the investigation that are capturing a lot of public attention right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, that's right. And I'll get to that in just a second. But first, let me say, if you look at the groups that are out there doing stuff, you mentioned American Action Network. That's one. Certainly the Koch Brothers Network is now starting to do an advertising campaign that's supportive of tax reform generally, and even supportive of some of the sort of vague outline that Donald Trump, has put out on it. But those are not groups that are sort of stocked with money that comes from donors who were supportive of Trump. In fact, most of the mega donor class was not supportive of Trump. There are a handful of folks who were. The Mercers certainly are in that group. The DeVosses, they were represented at this summit, as was Paul Singer, who was actually a leader of the Never Trump movement, a leading funder of the Never Trump movement. But look, I mean, it's true that the Trump administration has not done a ton to bring these donors along. They are not really good at donor maintenance. This is a classic donor maintenance type thing. It was certainly notable for the timing of it, but it's also notable that they actually are doing it because they have not done a ton of it. And I think that shows in some of the lack of outside group support. The Mercers have been out there. They do have a group that has actually gone after Comey in ads saying that he's a partisan. But that's really the exception. There aren't a lot of Trump donors who are spending a lot of money to support the agenda. Now, as to the backdrop and as to what's sort of preventing it. Yes, the Russia stuff is not going away. The Washington Post, as you alluded to, Scott, last night popped a story saying that, quoting five intelligence officials, saying that the Mueller investigation is now looking to explore this obstruction of justice issue more broadly than just with Comey, that they want to talk to Dan Coats, the director of national intelligence, Mike Rogers, the head of the NSA, and Rogers' deputy. And they have all agreed to be interviewed by Mueller. And the understanding, what the Post is reporting, is that it is about this claim that Trump or his team sought to obstruct the investigation into Russia. That's a just 100% self-inflicted wound, and it shows why they're having such a hard time moving past these the sort of Russia issue.
Well, I also just feel like I feel like Trump is sort of at the root of all these problems, and there, a lot of them are self-inflicted. Like, you know, he decided to fire the FBI director. Like, how will we look back on that? How will presidents in the future, you know, look back on that decision? And also just in terms of his policy agenda, I don't think that he himself or the people around him have grasped the way that, you know, a president frequently needs to either like kick off a big policy push or bring it home. And, you know, yes, he brought home helping the House pass its health care bill, but then he stepped all over it earlier this week by telling Republican senators in a closed door meeting that the House bill was mean. And so, you know, what is that going to say to Republican senators? Are they going to want to vote for a bill that the president will then trash, you know, a few weeks later? It doesn't really instill a lot of confidence in people on the Hill.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. He is the one who's sabotaging his legislative agenda. He is the one who's adding fuel to the fire on Russia. And so to blame Democrats or Republicans in Congress or the FBI or big donors, all that kind of misses the point. It is, however, consistent with how Trump has proceeded in much of his public life, which is when something goes wrong, the buck definitely does not stop with him.
Let's take a quick break before our next segment to hear from a sponsor. All right. Our third and final data point for – or our third and final segment, I should say, for this episode has a data point of 1.3 points was the margin of victory for Republican Ed Gillespie in Virginia's Republican gubernatorial primary on Tuesday night. Now, as listeners may recall from last week, we were pretty focused on the Democratic side of that race. Gillespie was expected to skate to the Republican nomination. This is the former Republican National Committee chairman and the 2014 nominee for Senate in Virginia. So pretty well-known, well-established guy. We have in studio today to talk about it, Kevin Robillard, a campaign pro reporter who was keeping pretty close track of this race for the last few months. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, Scott.
So tell us, how did Gillespie almost get snuck up on – well, did get snuck up on, just didn't end up losing in this race versus Corey Stewart? Who's Corey Stewart?
So Corey Stewart is the county executive of Prince William County, Virginia, which people act like it's rural or small. It's not. It's an outer ring suburb of D.C. It's pretty quickly growing. It's actually now majority minority, although the electorates that elect Stewart are usually majority white because he gets elected in sort of off year elections. And he's a pretty serious politician. He's a guy who's won in this fairly large county four times before, but he's also considered a bit of a sideshow character at times. Throughout much of this race, he was really focused on the issue of preventing the removal of Confederate memorials throughout Virginia, which is not anyone's idea of generally a top button issue, even in a Republican primary. And so a lot of people really discounted him. Most of the public polling had him well behind Gillespie. But he was able to sneak up on Gillespie in part because Gillespie sort of stopped campaigning for the last month. He was up on the air with television ads, but those television ads were as much general election focused as they were focused on the primary. They mostly just talked about his plans for tax cuts, didn't really address a lot of hot button social issues that the Republican base likes to hear about, like abortion, for instance. And so Gillespie just sort of shut down, didn't really participate in debates, basically wasn't campaigning all that hard for the last month, and sort of used this old playbook that you used to use against primary challengers where you wouldn't acknowledge them. He didn't attack Stewart ever. He would respond to Stewart's attacks occasionally, but mostly he seemed to be trying to not leave any oxygen for Stewart and not really get in a one-on-one battle with him at all.
And I think there was also probably another lesson that we could all keep learning about polling in all this, that even though Gillespie was well ahead in all the polling, he never had a majority. And I think that's probably becoming a more and more important thing to keep track of, especially in the wake of the 2016 election, what happened with Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, stuff like that. But the a little bit more kind of skepticism of leads that still have a large number of undecideds in there. But more broadly, I mean, there were some commentary on Twitter and from Republican strategists on Tuesday night into Wednesday about what this kind of says about where their base is, where the party base writ large is right now, and whether the folks who are supposed to be thinking about this sort of thing have really come to grips with the degree to which being a pro-Trump candidate can animate the base and the kind of transformation within the primary electorate of their party.
Well, I mean, let's not forget this isn't over. If it works out, if Gillespie is able to pull this off, maybe this will be the blueprint, you know, that he sort of stayed away from the divisive issues that do animate the base, which would have been...
If he's able to pull off the general election win, you mean.
Exactly.
I see.
I mean, he's in pretty good position. He's a smart dude. He's a good candidate. I mean, he's a candidate who is sort of vulnerable to challenges from the base, but it's that old Jeb Bush maxim that didn't work out so well for Jeb in 2016. You gotta be willing to lose the primary to win the general. Ed Gillespie's in pretty good position right now. I'd also like to point out and take this back to 2014 when Gillespie ran a surprisingly strong campaign against Mark Warner, the sitting senator from Virginia, former governor of Virginia. And he almost beat him despite the polls showing him not really within striking distance. And I think that shows that, you know, his people, his team, he's got like the savviest folks in Republican politics working for him. And yeah, it's a liability that he has this background in Republican politics. I mean, he's not just the former chair of the RNC. This guy like created super PACs, like he and Karl Rove are like the creators of the big money era that Donald Trump ran against. Nonetheless, I think he's kind of in the catbird seat right now, and it'll be something that Republicans will look to in 2018 as if Trump continues to be toxic or becomes more toxic, they'll try to be like Ed.
That's an interesting point. I hadn't thought about it that way. So now Gillespie is preparing, as Ken alluded to face Democratic Lieutenant Governor Ralph Northam in the general election. This is going to be one of the most closely watched, biggest races of 2017. At least November 2017. We've also got the Georgia special election coming up next week, which we'll talk about a little bit in a moment. But Kevin, tell us a little bit about Northam's primary win on the Democratic side. Again, we discussed this last week. It was expected to be pretty close. It was held up as this example of the battle royale between the wings of the Democratic Party. But there was a little bit more to it than that.
Yeah, it's difficult to draw a real ideological conclusion from this. When in reality, Northam had so many advantages of just endorsements, money. He blocked and tackled better than Perriello did. Every single statewide official in Virginia and every single Democratic member of Virginia's state legislature had endorsed Northam. That is just an astonishing feat for someone who faced a primary. No one flipped after Perriello got in the race. That matters a lot. The other thing is Northam ended up outspending Perriello by about a 2-to-1 margin on television. Neither one of these guys was particularly well known. And really, when a candidate isn't very well known, if you can just see on TV that they've been endorsed in the case of Northam by, you know, the fairly popular governor of the state, the state's two fairly popular senators, by an abortion rights group like NARAL, that if you're a Democratic primary voter, you probably have a pretty fond opinion of, all of that's going to help a lot. The other thing that matters here is that Northam and Perriello were never really a good liberal versus moderate matchup.
Northam was pretty liberal.
Northam's pretty liberal. And really, both of these guys started their careers out as moderates and have become more liberal over time.
I think that's actually one of the most interesting things. And, you know, it's been a while since we've thought about this because the campaign was raging and so on. But the Northam is a guy who has said he voted for George W. Bush for president twice. Perriello is a guy who, when he ran for Congress the first time and won in 2008, part of his platform was encouraging self-deportation population of undocumented immigrants, not exactly in the main line of the current Democratic Party, but where you know, and kind of shows how far the party has shifted since these guys got their start.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that there is something that you can actually read into it to quibble a little bit with my boy Kay Robes over here about the sort of battle for the soul of the Democratic Party. I agree that it's local. This was an example of like local concerns and local endorsements, local personalities trumping, sort of overriding the national perspective. But from that national perspective, there were folks who were projecting, influential folks who were projecting onto Perriello this mantle of the Bernie Sanders wing of the party, or the Obama wing of the party. He ran ads of himself with Obama in sort of near saturation levels down the stretch there. He got big money into a super PAC from George Soros, from, I think, Simons, from some of these other
– Sussman.
Sussman, yeah. Not Simons, right. Some of these other major New York liberal donors who are like the funders of the resistance and of the sort of, you know, keepers of the flame of the liberal wing of the party. They saw this as a chance to say something about the direction of the party, and they lost.
Well, I think you're absolutely right that there was an enormous attempt to impose an analytical framework on the race on the Democratic side, and to say that Perriello was the resistance, the left-wing candidate, and Northam was the more moderate. And in fact, their public persona or their public presentation lent itself to that, because Northam is, you know, the Southern doctor, and Perriello, I think, comes off as the more liberal of the two, even though their positions are virtually indistinguishable. But in fact, you know, that framework really didn't fit.
Yeah, building off of what Eliana said, I once had a Northam consultant complain to me that Northam's considered a moderate just because he has a Southern drawl. And sometimes it really did seem that way.
He's from real Virginia, as Sarah Palin would say.
I mean, the thing is, so is Perriello. He's from Charlottesville, which is a university town, but it's not one of these – it's not in the Northern Virginia.
Do we count Charlottesville as real Virginia? I don't know what the map of real Virginia looks
like.
Yeah,
I feel like we need to get a real Virginia
That's like on the outer edges of the D.C. metro area.
I would
Good
note,
food
by the
down
way,
there.
That in the polls, I think Corey Stewart, he was on – you know, his polling was underrepresentative of his actual support in rural areas, which is something we saw in the presidential election. Gillespie's support almost was predominantly came from southeastern Virginia, and Corey Stewart's support almost predominantly came from the entire rest of the state, which is more rural areas, and something to watch going forward.
I mean, that gets back to another thing we were talking about polling before, that Republican pollsters were talking about after the 2016 election. Obviously, what polling misses there were in 2016 worked out in their favor, so they weren't too exercised about it in the moment. But we're talking about, it's really hard to poll to poll the rural sections of states, the way with response rates to polling going down, and the fact that there's less population there, you know, by geography, it makes it really difficult to get an accurate sample. And with kind of the results of elections stratifying by urban versus rural, and urban and suburban versus rural at this point, that makes it really difficult to get an accurate read on what an entire state is doing. So that's probably something we should really keep an eye on for the general election between Gillespie and Northam that's going to be going on for the next, four or five months.
It is also worth noting, Stewart also outperformed in suburban areas. He won Loudoun County, he just narrowly lost Loudoun County. It looked like he was winning on election night, but it's since flipped back to Gillespie. Loudoun County is one of the richest places in the United States based on per capita income. And Stewart nearly won it. He nearly won several other pretty wealthy exurban counties in Virginia. So this isn't a simple tale of, you know, rural Trump voters coming out. These were, you know, a conservative base voters who found Ed Gillespie lacking for whatever reason.
I mean, it's sort of shocking that the dude who ran on like protecting Confederate monuments was able to perform as well as he did. I don't think that's something that the big brains in the Republican Party are like super pleased about.
Yeah, and it's not something that you would expect. It makes sense for that to play in real Virginia, quote unquote. It doesn't particularly make sense for it to play in Loudoun County. And so I think there were clearly
Loudoun
some other.
Loudoun County is the home of Trump National Golf Course. So, yes. You know.
There we go. That's the key to the puzzle.
Yeah.
Well, this race, we're going to be keeping a close eye on it through November. Let's shift gears, though, right before we end. I want to talk briefly, again, something we talked about last week. We got the Georgia special election coming up on Tuesday. I said before, you know, Virginia governor, maybe the biggest what we thought was going to be the biggest race to watch in 2017. But when the two parties spend $50 million on a House race, I feel like that's a pretty good signal that they think it's important. That's a record, by the way. That's almost twice as much as the previous record for any House race ever. And we're seeing it's coming down to the wire between Democrat John Ossoff and Karen Handel. Seems like Democrats are a little more confident than Republicans right now, but it's a pretty Republican district, and there's a sense that anything could happen.
Yeah, it's not very difficult to find a Republican consultant who's willing to complain about Karen Handel's campaign, which has been something of a pattern for Republicans in these special elections. You heard complaints about Greg Gianforte's campaign. You heard complaints about...
This was before he body slammed
the
reporter.
Yes, even before he blotted. You heard complaints about Ron Estes's campaign in Kansas. So it is something where there might be a thing where national Republicans are trying to blame these candidates for poor campaigns instead of facing up to the fact that they're dealing with a very, very difficult political environment. But at the same time, you know, I've heard Karen Handel called Martha Coakley in pearls, and, you know, some of her ads don't really seem to be in touch. A lot of them seem to be bragging about her long political experience, which isn't something candidates typically do anymore in outside of Democratic primaries. You might occasionally see an ad like that, but not in general elections.
Yeah, we have seen this pattern with the special elections that we've seen since the election of Republicans sort of complaining about tactics of their candidate campaigns. And on the other side, we've seen Democrats complaining about the lack of investment from the sort of the institutional infrastructure of the Democratic Party and the professional left. I don't think you can.
Not a problem.
We're
here.
Not going to see that in this case. I mean, we're talking now about $50 million spent, including $25 to $30 million in the runoff. Ossoff getting a lot of support from national Democratic groups, ditto Handel. But, you know, the thing I think is so interesting with Ossoff, looking at his campaign finance report through the end of May, raised $23.6 million. Well, $15.3 million of that came from small donors. That shows that the base is energized, that they're pouring money in, as the Republicans would say, from out of state, but that they're pouring small donations in online to this campaign. That's a good sign for Democrats.
Yeah. I will say the one thing, it's talking to Democrats involved in this race who are watching it closely, some of the outside groups, there is this still this impending sense of doom, though, hanging over all of them. Even though Ossoff is averaging, he's getting 50% or 51% in a lot of polling. He's leading in almost every poll. But there have been so many close races in Republican-leaning territory over the past few years where Democrats went in on Election Day thinking that their local candidate had it, and the entire undecided vote swung against them. Turnout maybe wasn't quite as good as they thought it was going to be, and they ended up with an L instead of a W. We'll have to wait and see what happens in Georgia. We've been talking about it for like 6 months now, so I'm very excited to finally have some numbers to pour over on Tuesday night.
That's what it's like being a nerd.
Yeah. Well, we're going to be up late Tuesday night. Go to politico.com. We're going to have some amazing maps, among other things, of the results
it's
as they
really
roll in.
Great to be
I'm
going to
be on vacation between my two jobs, but I'll be thinking of you being up late in the Roslyn World HQ of Politico and missing you guys. And also missing the free food. Always delicious election night fare brought in at Politico. Taylor Gourmet sometimes. We have Lebanese Taverna.
This is presidential bias going on here. There's never any food brought
in. We don't get food
for the down ballot race.
All right, suckers.
All right. Well, I think that's about it for our show this week. Thank you for being here, Kevin.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Eliana.
Thank you.
And before we sign off, again, a very special thanks to Ken Vogel, who is appearing on his final Nerdcast today, as we mentioned at the top of the show. He's heading to the New York Times after a decade plus at Politico, an incredible run. And Ken, rest assured, we're going to miss you. Nerdcast is going to be a slightly lower volume place, as will the rest of the newsroom.
Right. Well, I appreciate it, Scott. And I had an amazing run at Politico. I owe my journalism career to Politico. It was the honor and privilege of my professional life. And it was a privilege to be on the Nerdcast all these months with you guys.
And as always, a big thank you to our listeners. Remember, if you enjoy the Nerdcast, please rate us, subscribe, and write a written review on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. The more feedback we receive, the better we can make the show, and we are always looking to make it better for you guys. Also, remember, if you have questions, you can email us at nerdcast@politico.com. So once again, a thank you to our listeners, thank you to our panel, and thank you to our executive producer, Bridget Mulcahy, Nerdcast illustrator, Bill Cookman, and our researcher and Politico web producer, Zach Montalaro. We will talk to you again next week.